This is The Illusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, tuck language into a box lined with straw and keep it cosy till springtime. On the 9th of November 1989, the demolition of the Berlin Wall began. Within a year, Germany was unified. East Germany, the DDR or GDR, dissolved and was incorporated into the Federal Republic of Germany, took on its currency and its rules, and its lexicon. Both West and East Germany had already been speaking German, of course, but there were differences from the years of very concerted separation, the attempts at isolating East Germany from what was considered Western culture and capitalism, and the specifically East German concepts that had their own vocabulary. I was curious about what happened to East German language after the wall came down. On with the show.
There's some words that still exist. There's some expressions you could still tell that these people, that the people come from the East or the West, for example. In the Western part, they say plastic. And in the Eastern part, I would say they say plaster, because there was a company in the East. There was actually just one company in the East that produced plastics. And that was called Plaster und Elaste. And because of that, all the people would call plastics plaster. And you could still tell today, if someone says plaster instead of plastic, that this person is probably from the Eastern part.
Plastertüte, plastic bag. I mean, I remember going to school with a plastic bag and being sent home because, you know, it was a West German bag. Yeah, these were very precious items. You would keep a Plastertüte for months, and you would reuse it and reuse it and reuse it until it was just tatters. It was a precious object.
For example, my son, when he tries to identify if someone's coming from a West or East German family, he asks them how they call the thing where you put all your bathroom items into is called. So East Germans say Waschtasche and West Germans say Kulturbeutel. And that's sort of the ultimate identifier, whether you come from a West or East German family. Wonder how it is like when you're in a mixed family.
Well, I would use both. I can't really say where it comes from. I grew up with Waschtasche. Probably that's from the East then. But today I say Kulturbeutel. No, I say Waschtasche. I say Waschtasche. You know, I so much understand all of these words that I can't really sometimes tell what I used first. My name is Etienne Röder. I was born in East Berlin in 1983, so 6 years before the wall came down and 7 years before German reunification. So I was seven when Germany became one country. Yes. So I did gymnastics, and for me that was the opportunity to travel a little bit, to get to know other parts of the country, other parts of Europe. So I remember in the early 90s, maybe 94, 95, we went to a training camp to the western part of Germany, a part that my family didn't know at all. We realized immediately that there were some words, some expressions, some phrases we used. I say, like, people from East Berlin, people from other parts of the country didn't use, and it was not by dialects or by regional tones of the language or by the way how people would pronounce things, but it was specific political words. And it's really, I really realized that these words exist, and there was a time in the 90s when I realized that these differences disappeared, that slowly they faded away. People would not use these words anymore, like me either, because no one would understand.
There were definitely a few words that were differently used in East and in West Germany.
Esther Miriam Wagner is a linguist and executive director of the Wolf Institute at Cambridge University. She grew up in the city of Jena, which was in the southwest corner of East Germany.
You had different terms for foods, for example, because also the foods were very different in East Germany. The availability of foods was very different.
There was a word in German, in Eastern German, that was called Muckefuck. a coffee substitute, muckefuck.
Couple of etymological explanations knocking around, that it's a corruption of mocha fo, false mocha, because the drink was made of non-coffee things, such as grains or vegetables or acorns. Or alternatively, it meant rotten wood.
There are certain things that you still only say in the East. Like, for example, for grilled chicken, we say broiler in the East, and in the West, I say grillhähnchen.
Yeah, you could tell by some words. If, for example, if a person says tempo instead of tissue, Taschentuch, then you could probably bet that this is a person from the West. Because in the language, people from the West, I would say by tendency, would use more the brand name of a product than the name of the product itself. They would use like the brand Tempo, which was a brand of tissues, instead of saying tissue. Can you hand me over a tissue? That would be like the East German form. And can you hand me over a Tempo? Would be like the Western German way of saying it.
Interestingly, the West Germans that I've mentioned this to have all been like, oh, I didn't think there were any differences.
Well, there were, but they have virtually almost completely disappeared again. It's very easy for a language which undergoes a different political change, you know, with different institutions and different social and economic and professional practices, to adopt a whole new vocabulary so that these new practices can be described. Yeah, so classically, you know, you'd get lots of words in the GDR which have party or worker or state owned or whatever, stuff like this in front of it. And in, you know, as against West Germany, which has lots of federal things in front of things. So, you know, so there were lots of new words. But of course, these words were describing institutions that are no longer there, so they kind of disappeared again.
Ulrike Hanne-Meinhof grew up in the town of Tiefengrün, in what she describes as the last house in West Germany. She's now a professor at the University of Southampton, and one of her areas of expertise is European borders, including the one that used to divide Germany.
And then there were these euphemisms, you know, like the wall was called the antikapitalistische Schutzwall. Now, the anti-capitalist protection wall, because the GDR said that was what protected them. But nobody in the GDR actually said that. They all said them all, you know. So there was a lot of state euphemism about things.
Antifaschistischer Schutzwall. Yeah.
That's how we called the wall. You were never allowed to say Mauer, the wall.
Mauer ist abwertend.
To say Mauer is derogatory. You don't say that. That's how it was described, that we were protected from the capitalism. Ultimately, it was, of course, the other way around. And it was, of course, used to prevent the emigration of the GDR citizens to the West. That's what it was actually protecting. But it was, of course, presented the other way around.
But despite state efforts, East Germans were not completely isolated from media and culture from West Germany or beyond.
All East Germans were watching West German television, you know. I mean, that in itself was of course, a way to stop the language from drifting further apart, because, you know, West German television was absolutely standard, you know. I mean, people had TVs and they had little things in the back where they could switch it around. And initially, the East Germans tried to blur it, but it was impossible to do because the country is not that big, you know. And so, and of course, the West Germans used it also as a way of propaganda, you know. It was good free world propaganda.
But you know that the media, there was actually a difference also. There was a sort of a line across East Germany, because there were parts of the very East that could not receive West German television. It's the East of Saxony, and they could actually only watch sort of East German television, whereas we in the Western part, we could actually watch Western television. And I mean, there must be some influence, surely, that we could actually watch sort of standard German programs and those in the East could not, or had a much harder time. Because, I mean, of course, you are influenced by
mass sort of communication.
By mass communication. I mean, but those poor people, I mean, we call them the valley of the clueless, you know. Das Tal der Ahnungslosen in German.
Interestingly, a regional dialect that was regarded negatively came to be the language of power.
A lot of the political elite in East Germany came from Halle. They came from Saxony-Anhalt. And that's actually a dialect area which has a very peculiar and very pejoratively viewed dialect. A lot of these political leaders were speaking in this particular dialect. And because they became the political elite, a lot of other East Germans would then also just start talking in this particular register because it was seen as the official state register. So basically, the southern dialects, even though they're only a part and by no means the majority of the population, because it was a dialect spoken by the political elite, it became then really associated with the East German state. And I remember that, for example, in my school, you had teachers who would speak absolutely normal German. They would speak high standard German. But as soon as there was some sort of official East German event and they would have to give a speech, they would actually change register and start talking in this sort of Saxony-Anhalt dialect, just because it was seen as something that you had to do, because this was the way that, you know, these politicians would speak on TV. Or
the language was kind of like a sociolect, I imagine, that you would really quickly could tell where someone comes from and what you could talk about or not, because anything I remember back in the days was political. I remember growing up in a time where there existed these two languages. It was like an official language we received through the media. I remember these episodes when every night we would sit together with my grandparents, my mother and my aunt and my cousins and watch the Tagesschau, which is the news program at 8 at night. And back in the days, before the wall fell, it was the AK, the Aktuelle Kamera. That was like the other news show for the eastern part. So I remember that when we switched from one news show to the other one, because the old one didn't exist anymore, we would continue this habit to sit together and watch the news at 8 at night. My grandparents and my mother and my aunt, they would just constantly translate or comment on the news that were presented in TV. It always seemed to me that my family had to reframe what we saw in TV.
But I think people from West Germany, I remember people being surprised when meeting Northern East Germans that they didn't sound different to them. They had this idea of every East German speaks in this hilarious way, which sounds really daft. But then actually they were quite astonished to meet people who spoke just like them. And then also to see that these people from who speak these very maligned accents, that actually they could say intelligent things. I think what people were exposed to in West Germany was basically recordings, television or radio that were made by the official sort of state media in East Germany. And of course, this was all very heavily edited and it was all sort of party line East German paroles and slogans, which weren't terribly clever. So, of course, people had this particular idea of what linguistic ability was like in East Germany. And people were surprised. I was in a church in East Germany, which was quite unusual in itself because very few East Germans were actually religious. It was sort of, I remember being taunted in school, oh, you know, she's so stupid, she believes in God and things like that. So I remember going to Erlangen with a church group to perform a play. And so we went into the equivalent of the church there. So there were other church-going people. And one of the children was sort of crying out and saying, "Wow! They speak German. I thought they spoke Russian." We were a bit taken aback by this, but there were just these ideas of, I guess in the same way that we sort of have certain ideas in, you know, nowadays about certain countries based on what the media show you. So I think a lot of West Germans had this idea of what life would, you know, social life, linguistic life, everything was like in East Germany, and it really wasn't.
The Russian was one of the languages you learned in school. So if you went to the sort of higher level of schooling, you learned Russian. And there were words that were directly, that influenced GDR German, which were came from Russian, not directly. I mean, there were a few like Sputnik and stuff like that, you know, which we all used. But most of the words that got into the DDR German, which were taken from the Russian, were sort of translations from Russian concepts. So Kulturhaus, you know, house of culture, and what are the other ones? And Planwirtschaft, planned economy, or Fünfjahresplan, five-year plan, and all these kind of words. These were all Soviet terms to describe the economic structure, and they were directly translated into German. So you get these sort of loan translations.
Basically, there was no religious literacy because people didn't read the Bible or didn't in any way learn about you know, Christian rites or Islamic or Jewish, I mean, about any sort of religion, because there was such a strict sort of secular line in East Germany.
How did they talk about concepts that there weren't supposed to be in East German?
I don't know. I mean, if you don't have the vocabulary...
Like, how would you say God?
Well, that was a word for God.
Okay.
There is no God. God is dead. Oh. Yeah, I mean... Yeah, not having the sort of specific linguistic register to talk about religion makes it actually easier to just sort of, you know, completely denounce it and say, yeah, we're not going to talk about this. There is no God, there is no religion. But it was interesting because a lot of the linguistics in East Germany was sort of marked by use of particular socialist rhetorics and phrases. So... when you wanted to talk about anything pertaining to the state or to social life in a socialist republic, you had to speak in a particular linguistic register, which had a lot of nouns. It's typical. They sort of when you have people talking in an official register, often you find that they use a language of distance, but they basically shy away from language of immediacy. So you actually don't connect to the person who listens to you, but you use a lot of nouns and you use this very, very abstract language. And that's what people did often. You just could not understand what they were talking about. It was just very, very artificial register they would use.
Well, why do you think they felt the need to do that? Could they not really handle directly thinking about this stuff? So they had to create these linguistic fences.
Well, when you create linguistic fences, you sort of keep yourself safe, right? You're not in danger of saying something that may be viewed as critical, right? So you can actually, with a certain linguistic register, it's very easy to hide yourself and sort of just sort of repeat phrases that you've heard before. I still have that now when I talk to Americans. I'm always absolutely astonished at the breadth of their vocabulary, how wonderfully they actually managed to describe their own emotions or express what they really want to say. East Germany, you wouldn't talk in a very open way about yourself, because opening up yourself is always also a dangerous thing.
Politically.
And I think that's one of the reasons I actually really had to learn to express myself, like, in the years after the change.
I mean, what kind of risks were you running if you were revealing too much of yourself before?
I don't know. I think it's just in socialist societies, you don't want to stress your individuality too much, I think. So when you start talking about yourself a little bit too much, I think that's always viewed suspicious by the state. You don't want to be too individual. You don't want to reveal yourself as thinking too much about yourself or about your situation, I think. But that's astonishing, isn't it? If you don't have the word, you actually can't understand yourself. You don't have the vocabulary. You don't understand your own feelings about a certain thing. It's astonishing, isn't it?
Yeah.
How language really sort of shapes the way you can think about a problem. I mean, there are these sort of Sapir-Whorf theories that have long been criticized. They had this idea that, you know, your vocabulary allows you how to sort of see the world in a certain way, which people don't sort of agree with now. But I think there's still a way in which the way you think about yourself and about the world is shaped by the availability of words to describe it, right? You can have a sort of an intuitive feeling, but I think unless you can actually describe it in words, it's very, very difficult.
So after the reunification of Germany, the former East Germans gained some language as they lost some.
I mean, the more population movement you have, the more you will have standard, sort of language standards being imposed or being introduced. I think a very mobile society is usually one where you lose your dialect. I guess this was also the sort of contributed to the sort of specifics of East German linguistics, because there was hardly anyone moved anywhere. I mean, you were born somewhere, you stayed there. Once people start moving around, then the regional differences get lost.
This caused a lot of grief, I think, also among East Germans, how sort of the cultural and linguistic heritage of East Germany was completely extinguished in the early 90s. And then it sort of, some of it resurfaced later again. But I think not being taken seriously linguistically also contributed to a lot of resentment that people still have, especially, you know, my generation, a bit older than my generation, I guess, so like people in their 50s and 60s.
Then there were other people would call like the time of the GDR the peacetime, Friedenszeiten. So they would always refer to the old state in the like colloquial language as the peacetime, or as the other country, the other reality.
This sort of what we call nostalgia, no? Not nostalgia, but ostalgie, it's called, ostalgie.
Portmanteau alert, ostalgia.
That you are kind of longing back to some times when life seemed easier because, you know, it was much more protected and rents were low and everybody had work and there were nice provisions for women, you know, in creches, for, you know, these sorts of things. There are both for good or for bad reasons. There is that because, you know, there is youth unemployment more in the East than there is in the West. And so, yeah, but I mean, I think the most important thing to remember is that any group that feels marginalized as a result of social change will always hark back a little bit to the good old times, you know.
Today you heard from Etienne Broder, Matthias Einhoff, Elke Schoenhardt, with translation by Marta Medveshek, Ulrike Hanna-Meinhof, and Esther Miriam Wagner, who, in today's Minillusionist, talks about her dialect from the region where she grew up, about 100 kilometres southwest of Leipzig. She says it's regarded quite pejoratively as German dialects go.
It really is interesting for me that, on the one hand, I'm very happy to talk in English, and I'm quite myself in English, and I'm very happy to talk in dialectal German, and I'm myself in dialectal German. But when I'm asked to speak High German, I just can't do it. It's because suddenly I lose my identity. I don't feel like myself anymore. I mean, there are these sociolinguistic studies by a couple of sociolinguists called Milroy. And they found that people who speak a dialect that is viewed as very pejoratively by the majority of other people will still continue speaking in a certain dialect because it gives them such grounding and such a large amount of identity that they just can't stop talking in it. And I feel this is exactly the same with me. When I speak German, I have to speak in my local dialect, even though even my husband hates it. You know, he makes fun of me.
How rude.
When I speak in my local accent.
Where's he from?
He's from the same area. And he pretends that he doesn't speak it. But whenever he's on the phone, immediately when he talks to his friends, you know, he immediately starts talking in dialect. He immediately changes language. But he doesn't realize that. So whenever I do that, whenever I talk to my friends and I go a bit more into the dialect, he makes fun of me.
What really struck me, it's only slightly related, but I'll tell you. I watched a movie which is called As We Were Dreaming. Mm-hmm. And it's based on a book that takes place in Leipzig in the 90s. It's called Als Wir Träumten. It's about basically young people just after the change, stealing cars, going to techno parties, you know, living crazy lives. And I think the visuality of the movie was fantastic. And the casting was also nice. But then I was so appalled that they all spoke in standard German. It just didn't work. And I know that if I watched a comparable thing in if you watch The Wire, you know, you would never have the, you know, the young ghetto kids speaking RP or like some standard American. You would never have people here, like if you watch Misfits, shows like Misfits or Skins, people don't speak RP, people speak their region dialects. But you had this movie which took place in the, you know, sort of the deepest linguistic heart of East Germany. And then they only the, obviously they had sort of some cast, some local actors who then actually spoke the local dialect. But all these kids spoke, you know, standard German. And I said, this is not working. This really isn't working. And for the first time, I really realized how perhaps it's part of the dubbing culture in Germany, because we dub all movies. So people are used to, you know, all sorts of characters speaking standard German, right? But somehow it's accepted in Germany that you will not take account of people's regional accents, which is very interesting, because you really rob you rob movies and TV shows of their authenticity. It always feels like you're in a theater play. It doesn't feel real. It's like a very badly scripted, you know, sort of theater play, though, because people speak these really awkward dialect, like don't speak dialect, they speak this really awkward standard language. In Leipzig, I don't think you would have had any teenager who would have spoken standard pronunciation at that time. When I was a teenager, people who spoke like this were considered slightly awkward and precocious. I mean, these were certain people you knew, but you didn't really get warm with them because they had this really awkward way of talking.
Did you feel like they were kind of pretentious?
Of course, very pretentious. Why would you speak like this to us? This is how you can speak if you go and speak to your grandparents, perhaps, or something. But if we talk among each other, we talk in a certain, sociolect, dialect. It just has to be. Otherwise, you can't really connect to one another.
Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is Tatparusha, noun, a class of compound words in which the first element modifies the second by standing to it in various types of relationship, e.g. possession, as in goatskin, location, as in field mouse, as the object of an action, as in guitar player, and as agent, as in man-made. A compound of this class. Try using it in an email today. And if you miss any parts of the randomly selected word from the dictionary, you can see the whole dictionary entry at theillusionist.org. This episode was produced by Martin Medveshek and me, Helen Zaltzman, with help from Martin Austwick, who also makes the music you hear on the show. Thanks to Raquella De Felice, Lynn Murphy, and Eleanor McDowell, and also to Adele, Thomas, and Lutz. This episode is dedicated to Susie Freak. Find Illusionist Show on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. There's merch for sale via theillusionist.org/merch. As winterful season is upon us, you can get a multicultural riff on the festive sweater. There are also very pretty typing t-shirts and totes, and some new t-shirts and cushions and stuff that should see off any people who complain about singular they. They can't argue with an etymological cushion! You can listen to every episode of The Illusionist, read transcripts, find additional information about every episode topic, see listings for live events, etc. All at the show's forever home, theillusionist.org.